small boat, he rammed it into the trunk of a large tree. He refilled the shell, flipped blood at the tree, and struck it again. Leaning close, he couldn't see any difference between the two holes he'd knocked in it. With the sunlight getting scarce, he backed away from experiments in favor of simply whipping a bit of blood around, sending the nether to it, and observing the results. By nightfall, this had gotten him exactly nowhere. He healed his fingers and trudged back to camp. The next day kept him busy watching the path ahead with a trio of nimble dragonflies, warning Volo whenever they were neared by a monsoon patrol boat. Now that they'd seized the capital, the rebels seemed to have taken on a new set of colors, a white flag set with two circles, one light blue, the other dark. Their soldiers were dressed in similar colors. The uniforms Dante and the others wore had become outdated. As they neared Darabode, the patrols grew more frequent, detouring them on five different occasions. By sunset, they were still miles from the capital, but Volo paddled on. Blaze laid his paddle across the gunwales and motioned to the west. "I know it's easy to miss now that the sun's going down, but did you notice that the sun's going down?" Volo didn't break pace. "What? Are your arms getting tired? We can be there in 2 hours." "Silly me. I forgot that city guards love letting foreigners inside the walls after dark." "It's better this way. We maggots come at all hours of the day to collect our bodies."
"What about us four, Hari?" Dante said.
"Your advisors. Brought here to speak to the monsoon." She brightened. "About the Drake Bane's plans in Malin, which is where you are from."
"That's more plausible than half the stories we've used to get into places that didn't want us there. Still, now that the capital's under rebel control, we should treat it like hostile territory. Let's do our best to not cause any battles." They carried on, the woods darkening around them. As they neared the city, the foliage grew denser on both sides, until it was only a single wide lane of open water providing access to the capital. To Dante's complete lack of surprise, it was blockaded near its end by a small flotilla of monsoon sailors flying their white and blue. Working on the assumption that every entrance to the city would be similarly patrolled, they approached the soldiers and were ordered to present themselves before a double-hulled war canoe. The soldiers asked Volo several questions, made a few disparaging remarks about the poor quality of her foreign cargo, and waved her on to the capital. The forests opened before them, exposing an enormous clearing. The capital was laid out like any other village, but the scale was immense, with the outer ring consisting of 400 feet of open water, though some of this was taken up by fish pens, before the agricultural islands and paddies marking the outside of the city proper. Past that, oil lanterns flickered from swaths of raft houses, and in the windows of the stone manors that populated the many islands in the center. Volo steered them around to the passage through the netting that surrounded the capital, calling out a greeting to the guardsmen watching their approach from one of the docks supporting the gate. The man stood, tottering to the edge of the dock, and lifting his lantern to spill light over the black canoe.
"Volo? Is that you?"
She shielded her eyes from the sudden glare of the lantern.
"Hobron? They got you on the gates?"
"You didn't think Commander Bahrain was going to leave the Drake Bane soldiers in charge of the gates, did you?"
"Yeah, but I expected him to put someone good on the job."
He flashed a toothy grin and beckoned them onward.
"Tie up and hop out, will you?"
Volo obliged. She hopped from the canoe and entwined the fingers of her right hand with his, a gesture that appeared intimate to Dante's standards, but which seemed to bear no more weight than a handshake. Dante climbed onto the dock, trying to look inoffensive, as Hobron gave them a once-over.
"Nice to go a few days without rain,"
Volo said, when the sentry was finished making sure they weren't obvious threats.
"Then again, if you consider the fact that—"
Hobron bulged his eyes and lunged forward, clapping his hand to her mouth. He glanced down the dock to where two other guards chatted and laughed with each other. He released her and stepped back.
"Sorry about—"
"What the hell was that?"
Volo stamped after him.
"I'll shove you off this dock!"
Hobron dropped his voice so it could barely be heard above the wash of water against the dock.
"How have you not heard? The monsoon has banned Danakide, just like they promised."
"I thought that was just something they were saying. How can they ban Danakide?"
"We already know the truth. What's the point in arguing different? It's just meant to confuse us, to muddle our minds and make us forget what's right. You know this."
"I know," Volo said softly. "That's what they told us."
"And they're right. So, what's there to worry about?"
"What do they do to you if they catch you doing it?"
"They glass you."
"Shit and scales! They're serious!"
"There's nothing more serious than protecting the truth from those who would slander it."
Oberon smiled, then grew sober.
"You sailed north with them, didn't you? Into the Gokaza?"
She nodded. Oberon lowered his voice again.
"Is it true what they say? That we freed the Aiden Rane?"
"Yes."
He whooped and clapped his thigh.
"Then Tanara Tain is ours."
"Yeah."
Volo did her best to smile.
"And they'll never take it back from us."
She jerked her thumb toward the city.
"Hate to rush things, but they're waiting on me."
"What's your business here anyway? In case my captain asks."
"Hauling bodies. As for the Hari, they're here to advise the monsoon."
Hobron gave the four outlanders a skeptical eye.
"Advise us in what? How to smell bad? How to kneel to little statues of false gods?"
This time Volo's laughter was genuine.
"Our leaders know what they're doing, don't they? Who are we to question if they want to hear Hari gibberish?"
"I don't get it, but I guess I don't have to."
The guard rocked on his sandaled heels.
"Well, try to see me again when you're leaving."
Volo stepped into the canoe.
"I'll do that."
"Clear waters, Volo."
She waved.
"Clear waters."
The others re-embarked. The metal gates, painted blue against corrosion, creaked apart. Volo guided them through the entry and into the farmlands, which were dark and smelled of damp leaves. The clouds were thin and were rippled like a spoon dragged through whipped cream, allowing the full moon to shine through. A tear slid down Volo's cheek.
Lay said.
"Is something the matter?"
She dipped her paddle in the water three times before answering,
"I can't believe they did it."
"Banned Danakide? Your peculiar way of saying hello?"
"I bet it looks pretty funny to you, doesn't it? A couple of Tanarians meet each other, and maybe they haven't seen each other in years, but the first thing they do is argue about whether the rain is good or bad, or whether beauty is proof of virtue."
"Hello is a lot shorter."
"Danakide isn't about rain or beauty or any of that crap. It's about hunting for the most elusive prey in the swamp. The truth." Our devotion to hunting is what made us who we are. Then the monsoon came along and told us they had the truth, and anyone who argued otherwise was trying to pollute our minds and keep the peasants locked in the Drakebane's chains. Their supporters believed it, and so did I.
There's no shame in being wrong, Dante said, only in refusing to admit it.
And in spouting wise old grandpa wisdom like you just came up with it.
Blaze swept his paddle along.
What did he say about the punishment for Donachie Day? That they'd glass you?
Volu nodded.
At high noon, they chain you to the middle of a dock, and they bring out a glass lens, and use the sun's rays to burn your crime into your skin.
Congratulations, Naren said. Your people have discovered a way to make hanging seem like a kindness.
The watery farms looked undisturbed by the recent unrest, but as they passed into the sprawling neighborhoods of rafts, Volo had to dodge around numerous planks sticking from and floating in the water. Four-man monsoon canoes cruised down the canals. The raft-filled slums had always been boisterous, laughing places, but that night, the loudest voices Dante heard were people coughing. Gladick provided Volo with the address of their destination. This was a manor in the well-heeled island districts. His contact was an elderly man named Fade Alu. According to Gladick, Alu's official position within the Drakebane's cabinet had been that of a roving tax collector, assigned to many of the outlying villages. But for reasons that were obscure to Dante, Gladick suspected Alu's job was actually a cover for his true task, traveling about and identifying potential talent to join the Knights of Odosein. Alu's home was one of a score built onto a shallowly sloping island. Volo guided the canoe up to one of the island's docks and tied it to a cleat. Gladick stepped off and waited for the others. Dante crossed over the platform.
Are we all going with you?
He will not wish to reveal his secret,
Gladick said.
He might kill to protect it. By arriving en masse, we may intimidate him away from such ideas.
He made his way to the thoroughfare that bisected the island, running from its low point to its highest. Cobbled paths wound away from the street to the gates of the high walls that enclosed each property. Alu's manse was located at the far end of the island, which, at an elevation of some 100 feet, rendered it one of the highest points in the capital. From its vantage, the only thing blocking sight of the entire city was the heart of Dar Abod, the fortress of the Bastion of Last Act. Gladick followed the path to the gate in Alu's brick wall. The grills were wrought iron, sealed by a chain whose links were as thick around as a man's wrist. Blaze cocked his head at the distant house.
Shall we yell?
Gladick slashed his hand downward. A blade of white light flicked across the air. The chains fell away with a weighty clank. He pushed the gate aside and entered the garden, which remained well kept despite whatever troubles had riven Dar Abod over the last few weeks. Gladick took another path to the stoop and its oversized front door. The knocker boomed through the house. The door opened with a mutter of hinges, revealing a middle-aged servant in an orange jabat. He flicked his gaze across the five of them with increasing disgust.
Do you even know the hour? Later than you can imagine. I am Gladick of Bressel, and I will see Fade Alu.
Then you will depart, and only return once the sun has given you permission.
The servant moved to close the door. Gladick extended his index finger. The door quit moving. The man blinked at it and put his weight behind it, but it wouldn't budge. He fell back a step.
Who are you?
A former servant of the Drakebane. Your emperor has fled, but I remain here to save your country.
The doorman's eyelids twitched.
You will wait here.
He made to close the door, which held firm until Gladick gave a small nod. The servant slammed the door. His footsteps retreated into the interior. Dante gave the priest a look.
You catch more flies with honey than vinegar.
Yes, Blaze said, but you catch the most flies with shit.
Gladick didn't respond. A minute passed, then another. Volo wandered to the edge of the stoop to gaze down on the quiet city. Naren had a distant look on his face, as if remembering old times. A lantern lit up one of the third-floor windows, then receded from the room. At last, the door swung open again, the servant stepping adroitly to the side.
Enter, guests.
Dante moved in behind Gladick, bringing a trickle of nether to his hand. The servant spun on his heel and led them through a brick corridor and into a sitting room, or, more aptly, a kneeling room, considering that its furniture consisted of a few knee-high tables and vast numbers of rugs and cushions. A man rose from the main table. He was about 60, and his slicked back hair had gone almost entirely silver, with a few streaks of deep black hanging around what remained of his temples. He took in Volo and the foreigners before settling his pale eyes on Gladick.
Gladick, you're aware our new rulers have outlawed Donaki Day.
Gladick inclined his head. I have just learned as much. Then you'll understand that I'm being purely rhetorical when I greet you by asking whether it's in the best interests of a people to strangle their ability to speak themselves toward truth.
I could not say.
Good, because I didn't ask. Just as I didn't ask whether the best way to win the hearts of a conquered people is to stamp out their holiest traditions.
If such a question were to be asked, I would tell its asker that the best way to ensure that a conquered people will never rebel against you is to reshape them to be the exact same as your people.
As a former taxman, you'd think I'd have more appetite for grinding people under my heel. But I don't even have the stomach to think such things.
Fade smiled with half his mouth.
It's good to see you. I'd have guessed you'd be dead or long gone.
The priest moved a half step in front of the others.
An unexpected calling has kept me here. I do not expect to see my homeland again.
Fade made a subtle gesture to the others.
And because you can't go back to Malon, you've brought friends from Malon to visit you instead?
We would not call each other friends, but we have all found ourselves being swept along by the same strange tide.
Let me guess. The one flowing from the north?
Indeed. First, though, what of matters here? Have you and your family been safe since the revolution?
Got them all packed up and shipped off to Bressel. Houses felt damn near empty.
Then why do you remain?
Fade pulled his lopsided grin again.
You're not the only one with a calling. I aim to wrap things up and skip town soon as I can. The way things are going with the monsoon, I'd leave even if there were no northern threat.
Gladick nodded thoughtfully.
Yet there is. You are wise to go.
The other man lowered his eyes to the stump of Gladick's right arm.
Looks like you got first-hand experience there.
He winced. Pardon the pun.
It's no matter. As I said, I have already accepted I will not survive the coming storm. Losing an arm better prepares me to face death when it comes without flinching.
You're even more fatalistic than the last time I saw you.
Gazing into hell will do that to a man.
Gladick tilted his head to the side.
Do you know why I am here?
To make sure I don't get any sleep?
The Aedon Rane has returned. I have seen him. We have fought him. And we think we know a way to destroy him.
Oh, batshit. The Drakebane did everything he could about that. If there'd been another option, he'd be out there on the front lines right now, not digging himself a new nest in Bressel.
You don't have to believe, but the Drakebane has abandoned you, and I am still here.
Thade scowled and motioned to his servant, making a drinking motion. The servant vanished from the room.
Can we get to the thrice-cursed point already?
Thade said.
Why are you here?
To save Tanar Etain. Our plan requires the Odosein. Do you know where they used to be trained?
Why in the Nine Waters would I know that?
There were rumors that you worked for them.
You can tell a lot about a man by which rumors he's eager to swallow.
The servant swept into the room, presenting Thade with a green glass. Thade tipped it back, emptying it, and set it back on the tray.
The location of the training grounds was one of the biggest secrets in the Empire. If I had so much as stumbled on it, my bones would be hanging in a cage in the deepest swamp.
Then you don't know where it is.
Hell no. I wouldn't want to know.
Gladick turned his profile to Thade, taking two steps toward the wall.
Do any Odosein remain in the capital?
You know they'd never leave their Drakebane behind. Any that survived the fighting sailed away with him to Bressel.
That was the conclusion I reached as well. In that case, I need you to stop lying to me.
Excuse me?
You know precisely what I am saying.
Thade motioned to his servant again.
Trying to keep track of all your Malish gods must have driven you crazy. I don't know anything about the Odosein.
Do you understand that this is the last hope for your country?
There is no hope, you loony bastard. I can't help you. I suggest you find someone who can.
Gladick turned to face him. The priest's eyes were as sunken as wells.
We didn't get a chance to engage in Danaki Day. I will rectify that. Are we agreed that liars are bad people?
What kind of question is that?
Do not attempt to dodge me. Danaki Day is the search for truth, which is holy. If truth is holy, then lies are unholy, and liars are their vessel.
The servant came back with a refilled glass. Thade didn't reach for it.
If a man lies to save his life, does that brand him a liar?
It does, when the man's lies will cost the lives of everyone in his country. Now stop dodging and answer my question. Are lies unholy?
Depends entirely on the why, doesn't it?
If a man lies to save himself from death, that is merely the act of using one unholy act to protect oneself from another. The lie itself remains unholy. How, then, might we rid ourselves of lying? If we killed every liar, do you think the next generation would be raised without knowledge of falsehoods?
I think if we killed everyone who ever told a lie, we'd have done the Aedan Rani's job for him.
Indeed. For lies are a disease that seems to run as deep as our own blood. Do you know the only way to be cured of them? To lose everything. Every single part of you and what you love. When everything is taken from you, and you have nothing left to lose nor to fear, at last you can see the truth.
Gladick swept his left hand through the air. Ether glittered across the room. Scores of footsteps lit up across the floor, a shimmering pattern of chaos. Most of them were adult-sized, but two pairs were much smaller. They led out the rear of the sitting room, accompanied by a set of larger prints. Gladick followed the trail out the door and into a hallway. Fade made a choking noise and lurched after him.
The hell you think you're doing?
Blaze trotted after them both.
Does anyone know what's going on?
A thought stirred in Dante's mind, but he left it unspoken. Gladick tracked the footsteps past the kitchen and down another corridor, with Fade hectoring him in increasingly strident tones. The small footsteps led to a dingy door that might have been a pantry. They stopped there. The larger set that had traveled with them reversed and headed back down the corridor toward the sitting room. Gladick set an ear to the door, then pulled back his head and lifted a quizzical eyebrow.
What do you keep in here, Fade?
Food! Roots and such!
Spittle flew from Fade's mouth.
Get out of my house!
Gladick reached for the door handle. Fade stormed forward. He was a heavy-set man with some muscle to him, and if he struck Gladick, it was likely the old man would fall. Gladick glanced at Fade's feet. A white glow outlined the man's sandals. His lower body locked up, his upper body swaying forward. He windmilled his arms for balance, but his feet and legs were so firmly rooted in place, he couldn't have fallen over if he'd been struck in the back with a mallet. Gladick smiled at him so briefly, Dante wasn't sure that it had been there at all. The priest swung open the door. The room beyond exhaled the smell of dirt and tubers and spiced sausages. Windowless, it was as dark as a cavern. Gladick lifted a finger and flooded the room with gentle light. Two young children huddled on the floor, arms wrapped around their knees. Between their identical haircuts, long on top, short on the sides, and the softened features of childhood, Dante couldn't tell whether they were boys or girls. In tandem, they stared at Gladick, then at Fade, who remained half frozen behind the priest.
Grandchildren, Gladick said. Stand, please.
Fade wheeled his arms, but Gladick was out of reach. Don't you dare, you foreign shit! I'll bait my hooks with your balls, I'll—
The priest jerked a thumb at Fade. The man's jaw clamped shut. He stood as static as a statue.
"Come out, children," Gladik said. "Into the light."
The one on the left stood, motioning for the other one to do the same. Hesitantly, they walked out from the pantry, stopping outside the door. Gladik didn't move.
"Are you afraid?"
The one who'd stood first, the shorter of the two, nodded.
"Yes, sir."
"You should be. For your grandfather would rather sacrifice you, and everyone else in this land, than to break his word to the coward who's abandoned him."
"Grandpa, did we do something bad?"
"No, child," Gladik said. "You are innocent. But innocence is the weakest shield of them all. It splinters the first time it meets a blade."
Gladik made a chopping gesture. Fade's head jerked forward as it was released from its bonds.
"Stop, you son of a bitch! Stop!"
Ether sparked on Gladik's fingertips.
"I haven't yet begun."
"Right." Blaze moved forward, reaching for the hilt of his sword.
"If this is going where I think..."
Gladik gestured again. Whiteness traced Blaze's figure. He stopped in his tracks, immobilized, except for the raging of his eyes. Gladik ignored him, staring right back at Fade, whose neck worked and strained. A halo of ether formed around Gladik's index finger. He hovered it over the top of the braver child's head.
"Get away from her!"
Fade shook his head side to side like a dog that's taken a snoutful of pepper.
"You're a monster!"
Gladik snorted in contempt.
"Your words have no power, fool. If the Aedan Rane has not stopped, these children are already dead."
He shaped the halo into a long needle, lowering it to the girl's face. She backed away, her back thumping into the wall.
"Grandpa!"
Dante's heart beat like the wings of a manic bird. Gladik moved across from the girl, trapping her against the wall, and maneuvered the glowing needle to her ear. Dante called forth the nether.
The girl screamed.
So did Fade.
"The hell-painted hills!"
Gladik halted the needle.
"What of them?"
"The training grounds are tucked away in the hell-painted hills. You want to find whatever's left of the Odyssein? That's where you need to go."
6. Gladik touched his chin.
"The hell-painted hills."
Fade nodded, sweat dribbling down his brow, chest heaving.
"That's why no one's ever found the place. Only the Odyssein's power is enough to keep a body from getting poisoned by the old magics."
"The hills run for hundreds of miles between the coast and the mountains. Where within them is the academy?"
Fade rattled off a slew of precise directions to the hills.
"That will take you to a spot known as Frog's Reach. It's right there on the fringe. The Silent Spires, that's the academy, is miles past the border. There's no road, no proper path neither, but the way is marked in gold. Follow the gold, you'll get to the spires."
He curled his lip.
"Except you will drop dead before you get a mile in. And in the hills, there isn't even any dirt to bury your foreign corpse."
Gladik turned his head to Volo.
"Are his directions plausible?"
She swallowed.
"I know where Frog's Reach is, yeah. But nobody travels through the hills. It's death."
"Thank you, Fade," At last you have found a way to speak the truth.
Gledick closed his eyes. The needle blinked away. Fade and Blaze stumbled forward, released from their invisible bonds. The girl ran past Gledick and into her grandfather's arms. Fade gazed over her shoulder with sheer loathing.
"Now get your half-rotted carcass off my land! I don't care what kind of sorceress devilry you got in your veins. I ever see you again, I will plant my knife in your heart."
"I would not blame you." Gladick bowed. "Thank you for your cooperation, Fade Alu."
They made way for the front door, the sobs fading behind them. Outside, the night air was sluggish and humid. Dante had been getting used to it, but at that moment it felt suffocating.
"What?" Blaze said, batting aside a low-hanging bit of shrub. "In the orgy of the gods was that?"
Gladick looked as untroubled as a man waiting on a shaded bench on a spring day.
"The guiding of a man toward the light."
"By paralyzing him while you threatened his granddaughter with a knife made of ether? Would you have hurt her?"
"I don't know."
Blaze skipped ahead and planted himself in the middle of the path, blocking it.
"That's not good enough! I didn't spare your life to watch you hurt children!"
"And I didn't go on living in order to watch you fail because you lack the courage to win."
"You asshole! Do you even—"
Dante stepped between them, barring his arms to the side.
"You idiots! Have you forgotten that we're in the middle of enemy territory? How about we wait to accuse each other of war crimes and cowardice until we're somewhere the authorities won't burn us with glass or feed our lower halves to the fish?"
Teeth gritted. Blaze nodded once.
Gladick made an as-you-wish gesture.
Dante wasn't entirely sure they had proper inns in Tanaratane. Conceivably, if you went to visit another city, you could simply pole your raft house to it and live in that. But upon asking Volo, she confirmed that, though rare, such establishments did exist. They got in the canoe, and Volo guided them through the endless canals. As soon as they exited the island district, she came to a stop in front of a three-story building skirted by wide porches. Laughter rolled out of the open windows. Rather than being built on land, the structure was held up by thick stilts, as though it had once been a dock until its owners thought of a more profitable use for it. Otherwise, it was more or less like any inn you'd see in Narashtovik or Malun, with the exception of the stables, which took the form of a miniature marina, enclosed with fences above the water and nets below it. It was overseen by a guard whose egg-shaped body was a local rarity, given that most everyone spent a good portion of their day poling or paddling boats around, hacking at plants with machetes, or shaping beams into new rafts and docks. Volo didn't leave her new canoe behind until she had thoroughly impressed into the guard that if her boat got stolen, she would, in turn, steal no less than one of his testicles. They secured a room, third floor, which Volo said would get a better breeze, and headed up to it. Dante bolted the door behind them. Blaze and Gladick separated like combatants in an arena. Volo sat on a mat in a corner, looking downcast. Naren moved to a wall, hands clasped behind his back. Blaze stood across from Gladick, held apart by a shin-high table. He hadn't taken off his sword belts yet.
"You were going to do it, weren't you? You were going to kill that little girl."
"Killing her would have been inefficient."
It had been a long day of travel, and most men Gladick's age would be hunting for a chair, but he stayed on his feet.
Her grandfather broke before she'd felt the slightest sting of pain.
But if he hadn't buckled, you would have hurt her until he did.
Bask in your self-righteousness. I, above anyone, know how good it feels, how intoxicating it is to condemn your enemies as evil, and yourself as the wielder of virtue's sword.
Quit the speeches, Dante said. You sound like a mad priest.
Gladick smirked at that, then sobered. Look to our results. No one was hurt, and we gained the location of the last remaining Odosain.
Blaze flung out his hands. No one was hurt this time, but if we hike out to these silent spires and they tell us to go fuck ourselves running, what's your plan then? Start torturing the youngest person in sight?
If such an act was required to stop the Aiden Rane, you would spare one child and sacrifice the world instead?
Some things aren't worth compromising on, you son of a bitch. Like, I don't know, baby killing.
Gladick lowered his face and pinched the bridge of his nose. Conventional morality works against conventional threats. But the threat posed by the Lich is beyond all scale. If we don't accept the nature of what we face and adapt to its horrors, we will lose.
Blazer's face had gone scarlet. This was a bad idea.
I'll fight the Lich with everything I have, Dante put in, but I won't become a monster. We can't give up our souls to this.
Gladick rubbed his jaw.
That would make our task much harder. Then we'll work harder. As if we weren't already. Restricting our methods will only increase the risk of our defeat.
Then we'll risk it. Gods damn, man, I've done more than my share of killing. And I do most of it again. Despite that, I still think I'm a decent person. Or that I'm at least capable of saving.
But if I start torturing children, then I don't get to believe that anymore.
The old man considered him for some time.
So be it. But know that if I must sacrifice my soul to end this, I will do so in a heartbeat.
Not much there to sacrifice, Blaze muttered.
Dante shot him a pointed look. The darkest solutions are often the fastest, the easiest, the surest. But sometimes there are other methods.
We have made a long and ridiculous career out of finding those alternatives.
Let's try to do the same here. Agreed?
Agreed,
Gladick said.
Blaze folded his arms. We'll do more than try.
Dante sighed heavily.
Then it's settled. With such an enlightened agreement in place, I'm going to descend to the common room and acquire a bottle of the local liquor. On second thought, I'll get two.
No! Naren pushed off from the wall, wandering toward the middle of the room. I can do this no longer.
But I just told you we're done arguing. Don't tell me you're against drinking time.
I mean that I can't participate in this alliance. Not with him.
Ah. Dante hesitated, unsure how to approach the awkwardness of the situation. Then remembered he didn't give a damn about Gladick's feelings.
I'm not particularly thrilled about palling around with my worst living enemy either. But the cause we're working toward is much greater than our differences. Right now, the five of us are the only thing standing between—
Naren held up a hand for peace.
There's no need to argue. I am already convinced that what you are doing is right. But I cannot continue to fight alongside a man who would threaten a child.
The same man who murdered my captain!
Everyone looked Gladdick's way, but the priest seemed perfectly uninterested in defending himself. Because he knew he was guilty, or because he knew that they would never understand the reasons for his innocence.
Naren, Blaze said, you can't just flounce off. Not after everything we've been through.
Naren smiled a little.
It has been an experience like none other. But it's also because of everything that we've been through that I must go.
But we need your help here.
Do you? Volo knows these waterways like I know the Middle Seas. As for the three of you, you can do things that would make most gods jealous. Myself, however, I am just a man with a sword. I can't stand against what you fight now. But I can be of more use elsewhere.
What's the plan? Dante said.
I'm not yet sure. I may attempt to find the spice route for Lady Vita, in order to win Alibolgian allies. They'll be the closest to this menace, if the White Lich breaks free of the swamps. I'm sure our war coffers wouldn't mind the assistance either.
I hope this will be over long before it comes to that. But if it does stretch out, we're going to need every ally we can get, and every person we've got working to the best of their talents. Are you sure this is what you want?
I have spent too long away from my ship.
Pride warmed Naren's eyes.
It's time I served my crew again.
He unbuckled the belt bearing his Odorsain blade and held it out to Dante.
You may find someone who will put this to better use than I can.
I can think of no better use for it than for you to use it defending yourself.
Dante ran his hand over his mouth.
Which you might need to do sooner than you'd like. We can't send Volo to bring you to Aerisosis. We need her to help us find the Odorsain.
I understand. I know how to navigate the waters. I will find my own way.
Volo scoffed.
You buffoon. If you aren't eaten alive by a swamp dragon, the monsoon patrols will lock you in a tower until you're as old and grey as he is.
She jerked her chin at Gladdick, then smiled.
So it's a good thing for you that you know me. I got friends here. Others like me. One of them will take you to Aerisosis.
You would do that for me?
You're the one rushing around the swamps to do battle with the craziest things I'll ever see in my life, all for the purpose of defending Tanaritain, a place you've never even seen before. And you're asking me if I'll help you.
Naren laughed.
Tanarian logic is a formidable enterprise. How long will it take you to make your arrangements?
Better make it tonight. I expect our friends here want to get moving at sunup.
He made for the door.
Then, let's be on our way.
Blaze reached for his arm.
Hang on, Captain. How about a drink before you run off on us?
Naren clasped his forearm.
No, my friend. There is nothing for us to drink to. Not yet.
He released his grip, nodded to Dante, and stepped outside, Volo right behind him. The door closed. Sandaled footsteps rasped down the hallway.
Well, Blaze said, I'd hate to waste a good pub just because one of us is too busy getting things done. Shall we?
Dante nodded, stood there a moment, then walked out with Blaze. They headed downstairs. The common room wasn't overly crowded. The local liquor was of decent quality, if inexplicably fishy-tasting, but they didn't seem to have much to talk about. And they were drawing stares from the Tanarians. After a single, if strong, drink, they returned to their room. With nothing else to do, they went to sleep. Volo had been out for half the night, but as the sun broke through the eastern haze, she rolled from her cot with an eagerness that made Dante acutely jealous that he was no longer young. After a quick meal downstairs, they headed for the stables, retrieved Volo's canoe, and departed the capital. According to Feyd Alu, the silent spires of the Odoseyin were located roughly 80 miles from the coast, in the middle of the hell-painted hills, which separated the southeast border of Alebolje from the northwest of Tanaratane. According to Volo, everyone said the hills were still as hostile to life as when the Yosein had first poisoned them against the White Lich. "I once knew a boy named Goss, who said he'd spent a day in them," she said. "But he used to bite off his own toenails. And tell us that if you went deep enough into the Gokaza, the fish had wings and flew through the sky, while the birds had fins and swam in the water." Dante shifted on his seat. "Do you know of anyone who stepped foot in them? You don't drop dead the instant you touch them, do you?" "I didn't. Not when me and some other maggots decided we had to explore them. But we were only in the hills for a few minutes before we all started to feel like it was a really bad idea." "Because you were scared? Or because the land was imposing that feeling on you?" "I think that it was a lot of both." "What exactly did it feel like? Did you get an impression of what would have happened to you if you'd stayed?" Volo screwed up her mouth, eyeing the patchy clouds beyond the canopy. "It felt like I was becoming someone else, and that if we'd stuck around much longer, whatever I am would have been lost." "Well," Dante said, "I hope very much that you're wrong." Gladick smoothed the front of his jabat. "What if it is only possible to travel into the hills while in the presence of a knight's sorcery-deadening field? Then we're completely screwed, aren't we? What kind of question is that? The kind we must never be afraid to ask ourselves if we are to succeed." Volo estimated the journey to the hills would take 4 days. Within the first hour of leaving Dar Abod, they were stopped twice by monsoon patrols. But apparently, Volo's status as a corpse carrier was still valued under the new leadership, as they were let on their way without issue. After the second stop, she took more obscure passages wherever she could. She'd assured Dante that she'd left Naren in good hands, but he feared what would happen if Naren's escort was stopped by the monsoon. Given local hostility to foreigners, Dante wondered if it had been a mistake to let Naren go, or if they should have accompanied him to the port of Erisosis themselves. A nice thought, but it would have cost them a week or more of travel. Gladick was, to a certain extent, correct. They were a long way beyond niceness. Dante thought it would be a long time before they had that luxury again. Late in the day, they passed by the town of Yeli Paid, which was nowhere near the size of the two cities they'd been to, but a dozen times larger than the outer villages. It had fallen to, or pledged allegiance to, the monsoon. The white banner flew from its small stone fort. On it, the two blue orbs, which Dante suspected were to represent the eyes of the Lich, watched over the town. After they made camp, he spent an hour working on the blood flicking, but nothing he tried provided any results whatsoever. He was starting to think it never would. Things were always passing from the world, devoured by the blind jaws of time. When they were gone, there was no getting them back. That night, he dreamed of sailing out to sea and coming to an immense edge that stretched from one horizon to the other, the ocean spilling into it in a colossal waterfall to nothing, dragging all the water and all the land behind it into the abyss. The next noon, as they approached the town of Uruhain, the clamor of battle swelled in the distance. They diverted, approaching stealthily, and watched as the righteous monsoon overwhelmed the town, which had apparently remained loyal to the Drakebane. The rebel soldiers seemed to be taking special care to take as many of the residents alive as possible, not out of respect for their countrymen. It was to provide the White Lich with as many bodies as possible. There was no talk of intervening. Beyond Uruhain, a swathe of settlements had been gutted. There were no obvious signs of violence, and as far as Dante knew, the Lich remained in the deep swamps of the north, laying the foundations of his power. It was possible the Drakebane had evacuated the people to be transported to Bressel. Yet for some reason, Dante suspected the monsoon had gotten there first, and that there was, at that very moment, a flotilla of prisoners on its way to the Aedan Rane's hands. He heard from Nak while they were 2 days out from the hell-painted hills. The conversation didn't take long. The monks had scoured the archives. The boat had returned from the holy men of Hukali Island, and Min had arrived back from Pocket Cove not minutes before. All of them had reported the same thing. They knew nothing of the White Lich, nor anything that resembled him.
"Great," Dante said once Nak was through. "Well, I suppose it's a good thing we kept Gladik around."
The old man turned around in the canoe and lifted an eyebrow.
"I'll continue the search," Nak said. "Who knows what might turn up? And I assure you that I have nothing better to do."
Dante thanked him and shut down the connection. Later that same day, his loon twinged again. He answered, hopeful that Nak had turned up an overlooked tome, but was greeted by Sorowin's hesitant voice.
"There's been a lot of fighting," the boy said. "Like, lots of it. For a while, nobody was sure which way it was going to go. Today, though, the rebels turned the tide. They drove the king's loyalists right out of the capital."
"Couldn't happen to nicer people," Dante said.
"But we might need to get them back in power if that's what it takes to ally with them against the Lich. The Brasilian resistant movement has likely already started. I need you and Rasha to join it and work your way toward the top. Show them the powers you can wield for them, if that's what it takes."
Sorowin said. "That sounds dangerous. For us."
"Trust me, I'd be ecstatic to switch places with you. Work slow and steady to gain their trust, Sorowin. When they see what you can do for them, they'll be clamoring to bring you into the fold."
After a bit more talk, Dante concluded the conversation. He spent the rest of the day thinking through the shape of an alliance between Narashtovic and Malin. Kali would be turning in his grave at the mere notion of such an outrage. But things had changed for the stranger. Dante believed the old systems were about to be ripped out by the roots. As they neared the hell-painted hills, the air cooled by several degrees. Frequent winds shivered the branches of the trees, which stood taller and taller, vines dangling from their boughs like colonies of sick snakes. The pockets of land grew few and far between, but blades of rock lurked just below the surface, obliging Volo to slow down and, feel the way forward with a pole. There were no more villagers, no more wandering fishermen, no more signs of human life.